This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Hello and welcome to the summer season of the Philosopher's Zone. I'm Alan Saunders. Now, there are a lot of people around these days who can fairly be said to be somewhat disenchanted with the legacy of the Enlightenment, that great and self-consciously rational movement of ideas that flourished in Europe in the 18th century. Well, shortly after the 18th century had turned into the 19th, in fact 200 years ago last May, there was born in London one of the most significant of the inheritors of the Enlightenment. His name was John Stuart Mill, and he was a logician, an economist, and a social reformer. But he's probably best known as a proponent and defender of a form of moral and political philosophy known as utilitarianism. Well, utilitarianism is still with us, and one of its foremost proponents in the present day is Peter Singer, Professor of Bioethics at Princeton University and Laureate Professor at the University of Melbourne's Centre for Applied Philosophy and Public Ethics. He's also co-author of a new book called The Ethics of What We Eat. So, when Peter Singer joined me in the studio, the first thing I asked him was, very simply, what is utilitarianism?
Utilitarianism, in the broadest terms, is the ethical view that whether an action is right or wrong depends on its consequences. More specifically, and in the sense in which John Stuart Mill and Jeremy Bentham held it, it's the view that the consequences we should be looking at are the consequences in respect of pleasure and pain, or happiness and misery. So on that version of utilitarianism, an act is right if it will produce better consequences in terms of making people happier on the whole than any alternative action that you might have done.
Now, you mentioned Jeremy Bentham, who's a generation before Mill. Now, of course, it's always possible with almost any political or intellectual movement to find ancestry going back to the Greeks or whatever, but I think Bentham is the person who really sort of focuses the idea of utilitarianism as you've described it. So what does Mill bring to the subject specifically? How does his version differ from earlier versions?
I think Mill is probably best known because he wrote a short work called Utilitarianism, which was a great work of popularizing the philosophy. It was engagingly written, it was relatively short. Bentham's prose, nobody would say, is enjoyable, I think, to read. It's very sort of staccato, short, very methodical. But Mill sort of presented it as a view that anyone could read. He also, and I think not always rightly, he tried to make it more compatible with everyday views. For example, people had said against Bentham that since utilitarianism just talks about maximizing pleasure, it's a philosophy fit for pigs. After all, pigs, if they're well fed and plenty of mud to wallow in and so on, can get plenty of pleasure. So it seems to suggest that's just as good as what humans can get. Mill said, well, no, there's a distinction of quality as well as quantity in pleasures, and the pleasures that Socrates gets doing philosophy are actually of a higher quality and therefore should outweigh the pleasures that the pigs get, or even a fool who, you know, just, let's say in modern terms, goes to the football rather than doing philosophy. So, you know, in that way he was trying to make it more acceptable to his peers, and I think that probably helped it to become more widely established and accepted, but whether it's a philosophically rigorous approach to it is another question altogether.
His book, the one you mentioned, Utilitarianism, it remains a classic. Philosophy students still cut their ethical teeth on it. Well, they certainly did when I was a student. But is it still current for present-day utilitarians, or is it just a revered historical relic?
I think you would get different answers from different people on that one. A lot of people do go back to utilitarianism and say, you can still read it with profit. You can still find sharp insights into some of the important questions about utilitarianism from it. And I think there is some truth in that. But to me, it's not the best philosophical presentation of utilitarianism. Even in the 19th century, I think it was surpassed by a later British utilitarian, Henry Sidgwick, who wrote a big book called The Methods of Ethics. And I think Sidgwick is much more careful, much more rigorous than Mill, but he's also less readable. It's a bigger book and it's a rather dry book.
How did you yourself turn to utilitarianism? Because I think when you were a philosophy student, it wasn't quite as popular amongst philosophers as it is today. It's enjoyed something of a revival. So how did you decide that this was the moral stance from which you wished to proceed?
Well, I think you're right about, you know, how it was regarded at the time when I was an undergraduate. And in fact, I became a utilitarian as a kind of reaction against the anti-utilitarianism of one of my lecturers at the University of Melbourne when I was an undergraduate, a man called H.J. McCloskey, who presented utilitarianism in his courses and proceeded to give arguments against it as to why it shouldn't be accepted. And in examining those arguments, I thought, well, there are responses to these arguments which you could make. They don't seem to me conclusive. And so I started sort of, you know, writing essays in which I defended utilitarianism against those responses. And I thought that I did so quite successfully. And I then sort of went on doing that, I guess, and eventually convinced myself that there were no insuperable objections to utilitarianism and that really it had a lot of advantages. It was sort of clearer, more down to earth than most of the alternative ethical views that were around.
Well, I should issue a warning now that some of those warhorse old arguments against utilitarianism are about to come up, but you've no doubt practiced your return of serve very well by now. But let's turn to your own work. Now, you're often described as an animal rights activist. And I wonder whether that's right, because I presume as a utilitarian, you're not that interested in rights, anybody's rights, so certainly not natural rights, are you? Your focus is elsewhere.
Indeed, you're absolutely correct. So am I an animal rights activist? It depends really what you mean. In the philosopher's zone, I'm certainly not an animal rights activist, because when we look at the term rights philosophically, that is not the foundation of the view that I hold. And yes, exactly as you said, I don't think either for humans or for animals that rights are really the foundations of ethics. But, you know, in popular parlance, when people talk about human rights or animal rights, I can certainly say I support human rights. I'm opposed to violations of human rights wherever they occur, you know, by and large. And I think that we should recognize animals as having certain rights so that we can't do certain things to them. It's a kind of a popular shorthand, so that nowadays almost any cause of protest becomes a rights issue. And in that popular sense, I don't mind the label.
So what is it that we should be looking at when we consider moral issues? I mean, it's not simply pleasure and pain anymore, is it? The argument has become a little more sophisticated.
Not for me, no. For me, it's not pleasure or pain alone. It's rather the satisfaction of preferences. So we have beings who have desires or wants or preferences, conscious preferences I'm talking about. So they prefer certain things to happen. And I think that in general, you know, other things being equal, it's good that preferences should be satisfied. So it's really the satisfaction of preferences and avoiding the frustrating or thwarting of preferences that I'm concerned with. Now, of course, when creatures can feel pain, they generally have a very strong preference for that pain to cease. Even if it's a pain that, you know, you might yourself incur because necessary, I go to the dentist, he's drilling my tooth, it's causing me some pain, but I still would like the pain to cease, even though I want to get the tooth filled. So that's why preference utilitarianism encompasses the pleasure and pain of the classical utilitarians, but it goes beyond it, it's not limited to it.
And I suppose you'd say that all creatures with equal interests or equal preferences are equal.
That's right, exactly. That's the right way to put it. Some people interpret me as saying, well, you know, the life of a mouse is just as important as the life of any human being. I'm not saying that because there are different preferences that beings with different cognitive capacities may have. But I do think that where you have equal interests, if the mouse has an interest in not feeling acute physical pain and the human has an interest in not feeling acute physical pain, we should give equal weight to those interests.
In a famous passage, one of his, you said he was a very bad stylist, but one of his more memorable passages, Bentham said about animals and whether it was proper for us to eat them, that the question is not can they reason, but can they suffer. Now, you could argue that suffering is really a function of having a certain sort of self-consciousness that perhaps arises with the use of language, would you direct attention away from the question of suffering, except insofar as we all have an interest, and the pig has an interest as well, in not enduring pain?
Yes, and I think suffering can mean different things. You know, I'm not sure whether pigs are self-conscious, for example. Maybe they are, but they don't have the same kind of self-awareness that we have, I would agree. But I think they're clearly capable of suffering. Now, there are some kinds of suffering for which you do need self-consciousness. I mean, I guess the sense of, you know, oh, how terrible the world is, it's dealt me a really bad hand, other people, you know, are so much more fortunate than I am. All of those thoughts require a whole lot of comparative thoughts that no doubt most non-human animals don't have at all. And I'm not saying that they shouldn't get counted just because animals aren't capable of them. But I do think there are forms of suffering or experiences, you know, aversive experiences, you could call them, whatever you like, that clearly animals do have, whether or not they're self-conscious.
What about curtailing the life of other creatures? I mean, one of the big differences between me and a pig is that I've got a pension plan, I'm looking forward to going on holiday in a few months' time, I have all these plans. Like all human beings, or most human beings, I'm future-directed. The pig can't be. So is there any reason why you just shouldn't come up behind it with a blunt instrument if you want to eat it?
I think it's true that we are future-directed in ways that non-human animals are not, and that means that we have much more to lose. If someone comes up behind us with a blunt instrument and kills us, we have preferences that are thwarted that then can't be fulfilled, which the pig probably doesn't have. Not totally going to agree with the way you characterize the pig. We don't really know exactly what goes on. For example, a sow, before she gives birth, starts to build a nest. Is this just instinctive, or does she have some sense of something happening? It's hard to tell. But let's say that she does live much, much more in the present than we do. I think that can be common ground. Then she has less to lose. Still, of course, she has her life to lose, and the pleasures or joys that were coming in the future she's not going to experience. So I wouldn't say that it's nothing to kill her. Some people might say, well, suppose she's going to be replaced by another pig that will also have a good life. That's a somewhat different case. I've written The Ethics of What We Eat. I discussed that argument. So yes, there's something to be said there. But, you know, my position would be that there's a significant difference between killing the future-looking human and the not-so-future-looking other animal, without saying that there's nothing wrong with killing the other animal.
On ABC Radio National, you're listening to The Philosopher's Zone, and I'm talking to the distinguished philosopher Peter Singer about utilitarianism. Now, Peter, this is one of these hoary old arguments against utilitarianism I'm now going to come up with. Forgive me if you've heard it 100 times before, which you probably have. If we take a hospital, and in that hospital there's one patient in need of a heart transplant, another in need of a kidney, and a third in need of a liver, healthy man comes into the hospital, why shouldn't we harvest his organs? It will make him and his family unhappy, but 3 other people and their families will now be happy. So the numbers seem to favour killing him. What does a utilitarian say to that?
Well, different utilitarians say different things, I suppose. What I would say to that is that if you simply focus on the facts as you described it, and you assume that there are no other consequences that flow from that, I have to accept that the right thing to do is to kill him and to distribute his organs. But of course, in the real world, and this is part of the problem of discussing hypothetical examples, in the real world, it's impossible that this will go on for long without it becoming known that this is what happens at this hospital. People won't want to go into that hospital because they'll be worried that this will happen to them. So there'll be this loss of trust between the doctor and patient, and people who are not seriously ill yet and can be prevented from getting seriously ill by early treatment will not get that treatment, and the long-term results will be very bad. So that's why we have a general moral rule that says you don't do this kind of thing, even if you can imagine particular circumstances in which it would be better if it were violated.
Well, yes, you're right. There are problems when we're being very hypothetical. But let me put to you a case that isn't hypothetical, and it was once put to me by the British philosopher P.T. Geech, a Roman Catholic and no friend to utilitarianism. He pointed out that the Nazis exterminated Jews, political adversaries, homosexuals and gypsies. But he remarks that the gypsies were so few in number and the target of so much prejudice that it is at least conceivable that you could make a utilitarian case for exterminating them.
I don't quite understand why.
Well, because
I mean, they obviously wanted to go on living. They didn't want to be killed.
Yes, but the sum of public happiness, given widespread prejudice against them, the sum of public happiness might be increased by their removal.
I find that inconceivable, I have to say. I mean, people may have some prejudices about gypsies or have prejudices, but it's not going to make a really big difference to their overall happiness whether gypsies go on existing or not. So, again, I think it's only if you so hypothetically make some assumptions that are not part of the real world that you could get to that conclusion.
Can I just ask you, you talked about, in the case of the hospital hypothesis, you said that you have a moral rule which would not allow you to do something like that because the consequences would overall be bad. There's a difference, isn't there, between act and rule utilitarianism.
Right,
can you tell us about that?
Yes, there is. So as this came up sort of philosophically and started being talked about actively in the 50s, I guess, we were talking about a sharp distinction that people were drawing between, on the one hand, judging every act individually, does this act have the best consequences or not, and not judging individual act by the consequences, but always asking, does this act fall under a rule, and if so, does following the rule have the best consequences? Now, since that debate in the 50s and 60s, more sophisticated versions have been introduced, and people now talk, say, following R.M. Hare, about two-level utilitarianism, which says that you have a level of everyday life where you generally follow rules, but just occasionally you might realize that following a rule is not, in these particular circumstances, the best thing to do, and breaking the rule won't have any adverse consequences. And you may then, from what he calls this critical level, actually decide that it's best to break the rule. That's more or less the position that I take. I'm not either a pure act utilitarian nor a pure rule utilitarian. I think that rules are important, and I think we should have them to avoid falling into distortions of our position when we're called upon to judge in everyday circumstances and we're not always in a good position to judge. But I do think that there may be rare circumstances in which we're right to break the rules, even though the rule in general has the best consequences.
I have to say that if, like Nietzsche, I were to walk out one morning and find somebody beating a horse, I would, I hope, immediately come to that horse's assistance. But I wouldn't, as I was doing so, be thinking, you're interfering with the horse's interests here. I would simply feel, no, you don't do that. This is not what we do. Is there no room here for that sort of, if you like, prejudice? It's a prejudgment, literally a prejudice, a sort of moral instinct.
I do think we have moral instincts. I think that's been shown scientifically, that we often make judgments exactly in that way without reflection or reason. But I don't think they're very reliable. And I think when we try and do serious moral philosophy or ethics, we should try and move beyond those judgments. I mean, some people want to say, well, we have them and that's the basis of ethics and we should just accept them. With that, I profoundly disagree. I think actually that what is wrong with a man beating the horse is precisely that he's acting contrary to the horse's interests or desires or preferences. And that's why you should stop him. And of course, it's good that people have this intuitive, instinctive response that says, you know, no, you don't do that, because doing that, this kind of thing, as we've described it, is generally contrary to the interests of the being to whom it's done. But there may be occasional circumstances where those instincts are wrong, and then we need to rethink them.
The enemy of the Enlightenment, whom I had on the programme last week, who was James Franklin of the University of New South Wales, is an admirer of another Melbourne philosopher, Raymond Gaita. And Gaita says that we should start our ethical reflections not from abstract questions about the foundations of ethics or morality, or from attempts to resolve conflicts between moral intuitions, but from our most serious moral experiences, like remorse, for example. It sounds from your answer to the previous question as though you would actually reject that as a way of thinking about morality, would you?
Yes, I do reject that. I think that if you do that, you're going to end up starting the moral discussion from things that very often may be vestiges of earlier periods in our culture, or perhaps even earlier periods in our pre-cultural evolution, which quite often no longer apply. I mean, I think, for example, if you start talking about our serious moral experiences without any critical reflection, things like revulsion against homosexuality are going to be, for some people, serious moral experiences that they're going to start from. I think that's exactly where we don't want to begin from.
Well, let's discuss your latest book. It's called The Ethics of What We Eat, which you've co-written with Jim Mason. Now, you've been writing about certainly the ethics of eating animals for a very long time. What is there new to address in this area?
Well, there are a number of things that are new about this book. One is that it's much broader than my previous discussions of eating, because it's not only about how we should treat animals, it's also about what impact the different food choices have on the environment, and you know, some surprising information about that in relation to climate change, greenhouse emissions. It's also about issues like fair trade. If you see a fair trade label, what does that mean? What's the difference between organic and non-organic? So we're trying to sort out people's ethical choices across a much broader range than simply focusing on, is this doing harm to animals?
Is there a limit to my moral responsibilities? Because when you talk about issues of world trade, if you talk about the ethics of world trade, if you talk about what our food supply is doing to the environment, it becomes a very, very large and complex field. And of course, I should reflect as seriously as I can on all the information that is available to me, or all the information that I can keep up with. But there are going to be limits. I'm always in danger, aren't I, of finding that I'm not doing enough or I'm doing something wrong.
Yes, I think that morality is very demanding, actually. And you know, that's also one reason I don't think it's an all or nothing thing. One of the things we say in this book is, you shouldn't think that, you know, if you're doing something a bit wrong with some of your choices, that you might as well just give up altogether and not worry about trying to think ethically about food at all. I think that ethics is demanding. I think that our responsibilities are very extensive, because wherever we can have an impact for the better, I think that's what we ought to be doing. But we don't have to, you know, have the sort of Christian ascetic view about this that we have to flagellate ourselves if we put a foot wrong. I think it's a matter of being sort of reasonable and practical about everyday life while trying to make sure that the bulk of our spending on food, the bulk of our dollars and our consumption goes towards making the world a better place rather than a worse place.
And presumably there is somewhere an end to a chain of responsibility. I'm thinking about the animal liberationists in Britain who are opposed to animal experimentation. And for them, the chain of responsibility seems to go to a hell of a long way, like the pub that serves drinks to somebody who works at a laboratory where animal experimentation is carried on. There must be an end to the chain of responsibility somewhere, mustn't there?
I mean, in some theoretical sense, I guess if the publican could make a difference by saying, I'm not going to serve drinks to you because you're torturing animals for a living, then that's what the publican ought to do. But I'm certainly not defending what everybody in the animal rights movement does. And I think some of the people in Britain particularly who've been opposed to animal experimentation have actually done the movement a disservice by targeting people who, in the general public's view, are completely innocent of any wrongdoing, and sometimes the families of people. And, you know, that just doesn't help anyone. It doesn't help the cause of animals. In fact, it harms the cause of animals. Plus, it's sort of nasty to children, perhaps, who live in fear because their father works in the lab. So I certainly don't want to defend that. And again, it's a difference between what you ought to do in practical matter of protest and whether in some theoretical sense you can say that someone bears some responsibility for something. You know, I don't know. That's quite different from saying whether they ought to be made a target of a protest because of that.
Just finally, do you yourself, are you constantly making moral choices? I mean, if you go to the chemist's to buy some aspirin or something like that, do you look carefully at the label to see what the drug company is and then find out what they get up to?
Well, I think there are, you know, diminishing marginal returns for your time at some point. So if it's a small thing that you're buying occasionally, it may not be worth too much investigation because you're not going to have that much impact. On the other hand, if it's something that you're buying every week at the supermarket, then yes, you ought to know what you're buying, where it comes from, and what impact it's having.
Well, I'm not sure what the marginal utility of your spending your time with us, but it's been very enjoyable.
If you have a big audience, as I certainly hope you do, then the utility is quite high, I guess.
The book is The Ethics of What We Eat. It's by Peter Singer and Jim Mason. It's published by Text Publishing. Peter Singer, thank you very much indeed for joining
us. Thanks, Alan. It's been great talking with you.
The show is produced by Polly Rickard, with technical production this week from Lila Schunar and Junita Palmer. I'm Alan Saunders, and we're saying goodbye to summer, so I'll be back next week with a new edition of The Philosopher's Zone.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.